This period of time is a period of Dharma inquiry. I'll take a couple of minutes just to give the outline for the period of time. And as you can see, that Leela and Stephen have emigrated. And so there are a couple of spare cushions which are here. And with the inquiry, it is an invitation to anyone who wishes to come and take a seat here, and some exchange, some inquiry then gets underway between the person and myself. It may be that in the time that you have been here, something has touched you, is of some importance for you, and you would like to explore and go into with myself. And that may come, of course, from the meditations and the reflections. That may come from the instructions that have been given, from something in the small groups, from the talks that have been given over the days. And that seems worth some attention, as well as anything going on inwardly. And the primary aim with these inquiry times is to contribute very directly and immediately for the insight and the inspiration or understanding of all of us without any exception. The inquiry time as well allows for a exit clause, as I call it. And that means that at any time, the person or myself can say thank you to bring it to a close. And the person, she or he, returns to their seat. There's a minute or two of quiet time, silent time. Then I'll make another invitation, and then another person may wish to come. Sometimes with the inquiries, they last 5 or 10 minutes, sometimes 15, 20 minutes, half an hour, whatever feels necessary for one or both of us. It is valuable and important to remember that in the act of listening, so essential in human experience, that the listening itself is as full and as clear from you, from all of us, as possible, so that we listen, and that fullness of listening therefore includes the inner life as well. So we listen to another, but we want to be checking in and connecting with what the responses are as we listen. So we might be listening with interest, we might be feeling, well, that person's voice is very similar to what's going on for me. It might also be very boring, and you're just waiting for the end, like waiting for the end for the bell to come. So one wants to notice in the listening any kind of responses that are going on inwardly, because listening is a total event, inner and outer listening. So this is the primary purpose there. But do remember that sometimes person may ask myself a question, which is fair enough, and particularly if they're difficult, I tend to avoid trying to answer them, and redirect the question or questions back to the person without the person realizing what I'm up to. But the primary is a contribution to hopefully towards some insight and understanding. And finally, please keep it as much as possible connected with the retreat. So nothing outside about the daily life and da da da. There's plenty going on in the daily life here. So we try to keep it in the as much as possible in the here and now of today or the retreat. So enough from me. Anyone who would like to come and take a seat, As you see, there's one microphone. So, like, is it a Buddhist microphone which can get detached? Wicked. Easy. I don't want to pull on it and break it, and Tobin finds itself bankrupt. So we'll do the microphone holding and just pass it backwards and forwards. All right, so anyone who has anything you'd like to touch upon, ask about, share, speak about, you're invited, and at any point, at any time, you can say thank you, it's enough, and leave. Yes. That's better. That's easy. What would you like to touch upon?
First, I'm very excited.
Did you hear that? First time and very excited.
My eyes are looking. So, I'd like to explore or talk about the relationship of Dharma with lust. For me, it seemed to be very useful as for my experience of lust. And
I know a little bit about Dharma, but explain a little bit about the... You said lust. Lost. Oh, lost. Lust is more interesting, but lust... But all right, we'll go for the lost. Oh, well. It's all right. It's very... Lost. Lost. Oh, S-S. Oh, I'm through. All right, I'm sorry. Loss. To lose. All right. Okay. All right. That's important.
I thought I had good English.
You do. It's just news. So, would you like, in speaking about loss, because serious and important area, is there any event or story or situation, or if you wish?
Yes, well, I've recently lost, without a T, lost,
yes.
Lose. Someone very close to me, my big brother's wife, she was sick, she had cancer, and she died a few months ago.
Yes.
And I was very lucky to already find the Dharma to help me deal with that. During her dying at the death point and the grieving after. So for me, I was very lucky because I found my way of dealing. But I feel now that I can handle the pain, but that I can't use my practice to help my brother's pain or the kids, and that is the pain that is coming up now, not her absence, but the pain that she left behind. And yeah, that's
In the relationship to the other, there, and these experiences and thoughts can arise, of course, with regard to the other. Is it, where, or why do you have the view I can't help. What's giving the confirmation of that view?
Because no matter what I do, the pain is still there. I see it, I feel it.
So the sad event, of course, of your brother's wife dying a few months ago, there is the wish to give support there. Of course, that intimacy and closeness, presumably over years, there will leave often quite a lot of pain behind there. But is it that you are looking for some quick change, and that which you are giving with love, kindness, service, support to them, that you're currently you're forming the view because you're not getting the results that you want?
Yes, because I want a different result. I want a different reality. I want the pain to be over.
So, when is give support, the love is given. Of course, there is the natural wish for their pain and their grief and their despair and sorrow to finish as quickly as possible. But what happens when we have the view that what I'm offering isn't working, it isn't changing anything, and we keep to that view and that belief?
I'm not sure that what I'm offering is not enough. It's what I can offer. I know that it's a lot. I know what I do is a lot.
You're doing fine. So, isn't it important in the demonstration and the actualization of love to trust in that, and possibly at some point that it will or is already making a real contribution to the healing process? And just at the present time, it's not clear nor obvious to you. She whispered maybe so quietly I hardly heard it. The voice didn't carry any confidence in it. So I'm going to repeat the question. We give love. We cannot know or see at the time that it is contributing to some healing process. We see the pain of the other, the anguish, the hurt, the disappointment, the regrets, the despair in the outcome of loss, of death. And then doubt very easily, or the maybes easily come in. Are we going to take more notice of our doubts and maybes, or are we going to keep the conviction that the action of the offer of love goes on, regardless?
Just that I know what I do has the effect that... Wait. The effect of something, of moving, but I feel a bit selfish because luckily for me, sometimes I see it, but I'm not sure my brother who has a pain sees it. So for me, I have a better view, maybe.
There is the privilege, I agree, nothing selfish about it, there is the privilege of the better view. It may be, currently, a good brother may not see, recognize, or even acknowledge. It may be that you are simply sowing some precious and important seeds, the seeds of love, and perhaps 1 week, 1 month, 1 year, 1 decade later, the fruits will come and your brother will express great appreciation for your presence and what you offer. And maybe it never will come. But the act of commitment to the offering of love still matters, doesn't it? In the thoughts here, when you've been keeping the cushion warm over there and elsewhere, the general trend of the thoughts and feelings with regard to the family at this time? General flow. Is it love or is it doubt? Did you hear? Question is on the cushion, is it love or is it doubt? It's love. Good. Okay, thank you. So it's a quiet minute or two, and then there's another invitation. Anyone, anytime. Yes, please. That's what we'd like to touch on.
Sorry, I have a bit of a stage fright, so...
Take your time. Breathe.
I'd like to touch on the subject of control.
Oh, subject of control?
Yes.
I can't hear you, the arms are waving.
Control.
Control. So if you could control the microphone.
I've asked you a few days ago in the question and answer during the breaks.
Some people still not.
Still.
Yeah. It really. Imagine it's an ice cream.
Then it would be too close.
Black chocolate. All right. Okay.
So I asked about breathing. I find it that when I observe the breath, it's impossible for me to not control it. I have this inside rhythm, and I follow the breath, and I can't just look at it the way it is. Mm-hmm. And then you answered about it, and you said something about control. I didn't get it at the time, but afterwards you said you recommended making eye contact, and it was something I was very not doing mm-hmm. before. And then after, when you said that, I was like, oh, it's part of the practice. It was a real eye-opener mm-hmm. for me. And then I realized this whole issue of control, how I'm trying to control what's getting into my head. Right. And I saw it in many things, in the way I act here and in outside life, and also in my meditation, mm-hmm. in the way I breathe. So, and I still find it impossible, mm-hmm. but trying.
Sometimes the small event, remember, the God of small things, the small event is the fact, but it serves as a very helpful metaphor for many other events. So, in one period of time, sitting on the cushion, the whole story of our life can run through very easily. Habits and patterns and attitudes and presences and love and patience and impatience, the whole story of life on half an hour on a cushion there. And in the moment of something beginning to stand out, and quite often when it's brought, in this case, say, to a teacher or to a small group there, that the very fact that the voice actualizes something, that it gives it a certain priority, in this case, control, gives it a certain priority, it can be, not always, a real signal, well, this is a really significant area of attention in one's life. And just as you said, you can go from the particular, is there control over the breath going on? And then seeing it's going on in other areas. Oh, I shouldn't look up and have eye contact. It's control. Just keep my eyes down, not see people, whatever. It's control. And other things also then begin to stand out. So then the inquiry or the exploration is to look at control. And human beings feel a certain discomfort with control, being controlled, either from within or without. What's your concern about control?
Keeping my cup, so your good insights will.
My concern?
About control.
What's about losing control, you mean?
About losing it, having it, keeping it, rejecting it. What is control for you?
It's confidence, I think. I'm not sure. I can give an example. Okay. I write a lot.
You write a lot.
And I have this need to write, or if I hear something important.
Your microphone's gonna go
on. So when I hear. Okay. So I have this need to write. I write a lot my thoughts, and I do processing in writing. And also when I hear something important, like in here, I have to write it. And so I think it's also a matter of control, of trying to keep it in mind, to keep it with me, so that I won't forget it. Does that answer the question?
No. But listen, the wish to remember, and some people do, as you say, take some note. Oh yeah, sorry. Yeah. The wish to remember, take some notes, and some people like to do that there. But I am a little more concerned, and I think that can be quite useful for some people, or some people just trust and just listen, and just see what gets absorbed there. I was more interested in your concern about control when it's problematic.
I think it's the issue of trust.
It's trust. Okay.
Is not letting go and trusting things will be okay.
All right.
So, sometimes when there is some loss of trust, how very easily there might be some fear arising, and that then is the spark for the control. I don't have the confidence that the breath can come and go naturally and I can be with it, so I'll try to control it. I'll try to make it as I want it to be and put the pressure on, etc. I fear that if I look up and see other people and have eye contact with them, that might distract me. I might start thinking about them. So to control that, I'll look down at the ground, etc. So quite often, fear and control often go together. And confidence is the antidote. What will bring antidote into mindfulness of breathing, and particularly right now, because you mentioned about eyes, what will bring the confidence that you can look around this room and not just keep looking at me?
Because then my heart will start racing. And
good, wonderful. More looking. You'll be survived.
Just don't look back, okay?
The control again. Don't look back.
So what's the feeling in the looking out? With the microphone close.
Stress.
Stress?
Right now, yes.
Yeah, all right.
Yes.
Can you breathe through the stress? Can the breath go down into the past the chest, lower? You're holding the hand tight on here.
Okay, I feel like my heart is going to fall on the floor.
That's all right, we'll pick it up and we'll put it back.
She said she thought her heart might fall on the floor with beating.
And I said, no problem, we'll pick it up and put it back. So, no.
Tell a little bit about witnessing a group of people give a little, not too much, few sentences with confidence.
About what?
Anything. Anything you want to tell these people that you've always wanted to tell them. Can you hear what I shout? Anything.
Actually, there is something I want to tell them. With this discovery of the issue of control, came a great sense of joy. Really, it was just before you came here, before this retreat started, and I even skipped. When I thought no one was looking, I was really thrilled, and was really thrilled for people to come and to see familiar faces. And I just let go of everything and smiled and hugged and talked to people. And it was a great feeling. And still I feel like a lot of love for everyone in this room.
And of course, that loss of holding to control got you from there to make the short pilgrimage from there to here. So it's a lovely reminder to all of us that when we're not tight and we're not controlling, that it can release something very lovely, in this, your case, joy and happiness and appreciation for people. And only a little whisper of control was, I was skipping when nobody could see me. Only a little, but good. Okay, thank you. Quiet a minute or two, please. us anyone, any time.
Yes.
My question, it's about the Buddha and his message, and I came to ask it after quite many years of practicing Vipassana, and lately in the last 3 or 4 years I'm practicing Vipassana and also Advaita Vedanta, and find out that even before the Buddha time people get realized, and find out that there is a huge amount of knowledge and wisdom within the ancient Indian knowledge, and that sometimes it, for me, even at some point touch my heart deeply, maybe because it's safe from the beginning more and not allow everything to the experience. And my question for you, which I know you will bring it back to me, so I already thought about my answer, it's what is the main, the thing that make the Buddha for you, or for, let's say for you, so different than the ancient other Indian knowledge? What, because sometimes come to my mind the thought that it was just go against, it was more a social revolutionary, that go against the rabbinic of the Brahmins, like that the Brahmins become even at this time like the rabbis today, like, and he makes something very fresh and come with something very new, but at the core level I'm not clear what is different between his perspective, what he brought new. Now your turn.
But the first point, you're right, I'm not going to answer. For a moment, I will. I actually asked Stephen a day or two ago, are people here know about or have some familiarity with Advaita, with non-duality? And since it's a hall full of people with experience in practice, he took the view that most people will, isn't that right, Stephen? Will know there. Let me just ask it just a little bit. When we use a lot in Dharma here the word practice, but practice is not a word I would associate with the beloved Advaita tradition. And if so, if it is in use, what is the practice? Yeah. So here we use the word practice a lot, but sometimes our beloved friends in the Advaita tradition are rather critical about any kind of practice. But you said, for the last whatever 2 or 3 years, I've been practicing the Dharma and practicing Advaita, and that got me curious. What is the practice of Advaita?
I follow a teacher that taught retreats. 10 days retreat of Advaita Vedanta with a lot of time of practice like we do here, and with some knowledge about Advaita Vedanta. So it's not only, you know, hear this.
What's the teacher's name?
His name is Claudio or Sajananda. He's from Romania.
So Claudio is offering 10 days, and what, just briefly, would be the difference, if any, between Claudio and us here?
It's again about, of course, both are about awareness, yes. But in a way it seems to me that in the Advaita Vedanta, the first day, they give you the whole perspective of the deepest ideas yes. of it at the beginning, and afterwards you, in a way, try to reach to this place mm-hmm. in a very subtle way, and you know, not with too much effort. Mm-hmm. And here it seems that it's more open for a personal experience, and sometimes for me, as I told you a few days ago, a bit not enough emphasize about who we really are, the nature of the Buddha, the nature of consciousness, etc.
So, Christopher's opening talk on subject and object, and the emptiness of both and their mutual dependency and liberation from, that was a bit shallow, was it?
I was need to translate one of those, and it was terrible. Especially your English joke, and it was not shallow at all, and it was exciting. And I also, and I told you personally that I love it that you touch upon this point. But it still seems to me that yeah. in the world of Vipassana, I can say personally that after 10 years of in the Vipassana world, I came and then I heard these Advaita lectures, and it gave kind of in words what I was experiencing without to have this, without to know it in a way, about the fact that in a way, this consciousness of oneness, that the connection of Atman and Brahman and the inner God or yes. consciousness within me, and the possibility of becoming one with everything. Mm. And in a way, in the world of Vipassana, I do things that, and I also sometimes happy about it, but people speak less about it.
Would you, I haven't forgotten the original question, but would you regard being one with everything as the ultimate spiritual realization or attainment?
What you're going to say after? It is. I think it is. There's many ways to describe it, but being one with everything is one expression of attainment of a spiritual goal. And accept beside it this sense of this level of duality which I stuck in, like all of us. That's why we come to meet you.
What was your response yesterday when I spoke yesterday, which is only the second day on such superficial themes as Advaita form and emptiness. I'm teasing again. But what was your response when somewhere in that I said, rather than taking a non-dual view, in this case around ethics, such as, well, there is this and there is that, which some non-dualists take there, which I think is a foolish and naive position, rather than looking at what the suffering is, to really attending to it, in this case in terms of ethics there, and not being kind of nicely inclusive of both. and saying that violence and theft and abuse and lying really need some real attention. And when you go to in any of the traditions, are you getting a very, very clear underlying voice of the deep significance of ethics? Unmistakably clear voice.
I don't know much of the word of Advaita. You know, I practice this teacher, so I cannot say in general. Love to be a beginner.
Alright.
And but I never heard this clarity about ethics like it's come this sila issues in the beginning of most of the retreat I was attending in the Vipassana world.
Why? We could start off, as you say, at the deep end. It is lovely, and I agree, that sometimes in the Advaita tradition, it will start off with some very profound truths, and it will speak about them. I think that can be genuinely insightful and inspiring. I completely support that. What may would you say is also really significant, as we do with our retreats, giving a very clear reminder that all of these teachings have a very deep, profound, fundamental, underlying ethic.
The way I think and thought about ethics, things we can see that ethics in Western world, in Western religious, become so problematic because people stuck within ethics and not going into a spiritual life. Actually, the way I receive teaching about it is more that keeping the ethics is not because there's a good and bad, it's more because it's a mind which is killing, involving killing, etc., cannot be tuned, cannot be relaxed, cannot be subtle to meditate. And in a way, it's not...
Who says that?
I heard few teachers. I can't remember. That's the...
the Advaita?
No, in the Vipassana world. That it's...
people only not killing, not I never heard that.
It's not... It's a way to skip, to go out of this, being stuck within ethics. Which, you cannot prove in a way that this is good and this is bad. It's only relative truth, in a way. You're going to laugh at me.
This is wonderful and clear and firm. And it's a pleasure to listen.
I search for a way to base my spiritual life not on ethics. I take ethics, and even in retreats to become vegan and many things that others are not doing, because it's deepened my practice, and I know, and it's make me feel this strong connectionness to anything, to go and to watch the cows in the kibbutz and to see, don't want to be part of it. But it's not a moral limited view for me, this ethics.
Have you ever, I don't know, I haven't, I've worked with lots and lots of teachers, I have to say. Have you ever heard any of the yogis in our kind of circles and networks speak of ethics in a kind of moral, narrow view? Exclusive of spiritual practices, of meditation, of reflection, of lifestyle. Do you get the feeling that anybody's isolated it? No.
I need to answer to...
what do I need to answer?
The first original question.
All right. In the why I love the Buddha, is it more or less the question?
And what is the main significant? What is the new things he brought?
Is there any hope that what I say will be useful for you?
Yes.
Could be. Okay. How long would you like me to speak? I mean, seriously.
No, it's everybody is also connected. I listen to you speak.
I'll just make a few of the themes from the outer to the inner. The Buddha's approach has, and it shows itself through the text, a very, very strong, powerful, to my mind, exploration, which involves in that political structures, the rule of the religious authorities, the questioning of social norms, the belief in ideologies, the exploration of lifestyle, the care and respect for all forms of life, the potencies and powers of meditation and reflection, the value of community, the way of life which points to the great significance of love, of the divine, of compassion, of service to others, a refusal to place the self in the center of the universe in any form whatsoever, and an authentic awakening and liberating process. That's good enough for me.
If I will go back to my room, I will get nothing from this answer, because it's too many things for me at one point, and I already think about the translator and etc.
Would you like me to write them down for you, and then in bed you could read them?
It will be very kind, but maybe you can say the main things that the Buddha brought with him, which is making him so.
No. So I could add a few. He brought the great importance of that human beings are deeply concerned with suffering in life. He brought real attention to the causes and conditions that bring it about. He said there is a complete and utter resolution to this suffering. We do not have to live as suffering human beings. And he pointed to a way which addresses every area of life. Second, another area too, he points as well to the great significance of looking into causes and conditions which bring about events. He dispenses with the idea of the controller God. He dispenses with the idea that materialism and consumerism is the way to live. He points to a middle ground, and he said the extremes are one is boosting our ego up, and the other one is putting ourselves down. He says that's a completely unsatisfactory way of living there, and looking into causes and conditions through the middle way to really liberate human beings. So I've just extended the list.
Thank you.
Thank you. Time for one more?
Yes.
Okay, we have a quiet minute. I'll give a reflection on your lovely lovely contributions. Quiet minute, and then one more invitation. Yes, sir. Please come.
Okay. My question is: I have a deep problem with the gap between the retreat, you know, the life in the retreat and the daily life. And last time when I in the retreat. I decide this is will be the last one.
The last one.
Yes, because it's make me sad, you know, the gap, and till from the last retreat, I think it's 1 year or something like that. I stop meditate, and. The big problem is the gap. I feel that here is it's not the real life. And I'll give you an example, okay? Today, Stephen talked about thoughts. And a lot of blah blah about let's the thoughts, you know, go by and not catch any thought. And I have, you know, a big conflict inside, because I have a wonderful thought here, a big idea, you know, from how to change my my business or. How to catch my, you know, the lady that I want, and so on and so. And really, I have a problem. It's like this is not the real world. Really. And I don't know what to do. Stephen, you have an idea what to do?
Steve and I were touching on the London Underground message only yesterday. Mind the gap. What makes, coming back to precious Advaita here, what makes something more real and something less real for you? You say, it's not real here, but the real world is somewhere else, and there is a gap. What makes something more real or less real?
You want the answer that you and Stephen, my answer. Okay. Relationships between me and, you know, my close, you know, like ex-wife, children, etc., etc. You know, my how I deal with, you know, with partners and associates and so on. This is the real life. Here is, you know, 90 people sit in silence. I can't even, you know, if I want to say you, I want to say you are wonderful. I can't. It, you know, it's something wrong. Really?
In the daily life. And sorry. We could go to the silence. We'll take one thing at a time. In the daily life, if somebody is talking to you, what's necessary on your behalf? In the moment the person is talking to you, what's necessary on your behalf?
I try to listen. I try to listen.
It's to be silent, isn't it? Two people can't listen to each other if they're talking at the same time. So there's the element of silence. Could it be in the environment here, though there is a great deal of silence, but in that silence we might learn not only about ourselves, but what it is to be with a community of people, to notice our different feelings towards people, to feel a relationship stronger with some than with others, possibly even to have a sense of family in the group.
I think you explained the gap. Really, you explained the gap. Because here, that's what I feel. I feel family, I feel sensitive, I feel listening, I feel wonderful. And now, you know, Friday, go to the real life. Yes. Nada.
What was the word?
Nada, nothing.
Nothing. I thought you said mother.
Okay.
Good man. So, between here and there, aren't there times there when the feelings that you get here are found there, or is your life always miserable there?
I think I succeed to bring some of the I don't know how to say it to my, you know, daily life, but still, you know, after a while it's you know, it's disappear, vanish, okay. And still the feeling is this is not the real world, okay? And even I want to bring some of the feeling from here to there, I don't have the silence, and I don't have the community. And how do you call the sangha and the ethic.
Yes.
Okay? So it's like a shock. Yes. Every time it's a really shock for me.
In the view at the moment, there is a strong view, belief of differences. And the bigger the view, it will tend to mean, in the duality, here and there, in the duality, the view will give more reality in one direction, which is there at the moment, and less here. More real world there than an unreal here. That dualism or that viewpoint means that the mind is perceiving large differences. And the large differences make for a bigger gap, which makes it, from your speaking there, so big you've made it infinite. It is an impossible bridge to cross over in your description. You're right.
Yeah, inside I feel, if I want to leave the Sangha way, I have to leave the other world, and that's what I feel.
You're confirming the point. In the view is, so to speak, this is the unreal, this is not the real world, etc. And the other is. This view makes the gap. The stronger the view, the stronger you hold to the view, the bigger the gap. It can reach the point where the gap has become infinite. So the feeling of helplessness can get so strong because of the view that it's not worth coming here, because why would I want to leave the real world and go into the unreal world when it's making no difference to the real world? You're right. Why would you want to come? I'm not saying that they're the same, but I'm saying the gap is not as big as you think.
Oh, Stephen's whole talk was on this today. Blah, blah.
Blah, 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 yeah. Blah.
Very important blah, blah, I might add. This is a thought.
I have to think about it, but I have to say another thing. 22 years I have in the way, okay, in the path, okay, and still I feel the gap is not become smaller.
No. All
right. That's the.
So, teacher hat. While you're here, got a full day or more to reflect on this one question. What is in common between here and there? That's the only question you have to ask.
No.
For the next 24 hours, morning, noon and night, and I hope it keeps you awake all night.
Thank you, Christoph.
Thank you. Okay.
So we'll have a quiet 2 minutes and I'll give a short reflection, if I may. Firstly, a real appreciation for the kindness and the quiet determination for people to come and take the seat and share there. sometimes it's not so easy, but the goodwill and the good humor that takes place is an important aspect, because I feel it helps to keep the heart open there. But sometimes it can be a little uncomfortable for people. Just with regard to the first inquiry, and something that I think we all can know and speak about in a variety of ways. And what I have in mind there, that there are times, in this case it's the loss of a beloved, there are times when we give our love to the other, or others, friends or family, or through work or service there, and we actually don't know what the outcome will be. We may not know at the time whether it's helpful, whether it's nourishing, whether it's contributing to a person. And I sometimes think of this, if I may say, as one like a number of people here as an environmentalist, and wishing for the earth to sustain itself. So one, like others here, we engage in small acts, the God of small things, of what we can do and make things happen. But we don't know whether those things which we nourish and those things, those seeds, will ever bear any real fruit, or the changes that we call upon the corporations or the governments to make. So we have to act with love, and we act in good faith, and there is certain trust that possibly some benefit will come. And that same principle, I do feel, applies when we're giving love to another or others. We may not see the immediate response, but there is just a trust that the love does matter. It is worthy of sharing and giving and making that an act of a caring, humane person. In the inquiry as well, touching upon control and fear issues, remembering that many ways in life, of course, that we endeavour to have control or control over our life, but it does seem that the effort to try and control our life constantly brings various kinds of threats. And when we feel under pressure from whoever or whatever it may be, then the control gets even more and more. And of course, currently, many circumstances of this in the political world and much else, how more and more control, more and more policing begins to deprive human beings of their happiness, of their sense of freedom, and feeling quite oppressed by all, in this case, all the surveillance. So in just coming back into our own issues as well, when there is trust and confidence and the freeing up of the being, it genuinely can bring something rather beautiful out of our being, to respond to situations, to feel a much greater sense of freedom through not trying to control, and having as an alternative to not trying to control, to act wisely. And so some of those principles apply to the mindfulness of breathing and to our practice. We're not trying to control our meditations, but learning to be in touch with them and respond well to them, and keep some clarity in how we approach. And various ways and means, and the instructions in the morning and in the teachings, we give reminders to that. The lovely and precious tradition of Advaita in the community, in the Dharma community, and some of the voices of the Advaita teachers, genuinely feel have and continue to have a really important role. And I share the concern that was expressed, that sometimes we can kind of get bogged down in practice, 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 meditation, 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 and in fact get somewhat tied or limited to that. And Advaita, in its strength, does like to and enjoys to speak about some of the profound things. It has a very healthy discourse on this. A number of you will have attended satsangs before coming here. And there is a very good dialogue and communication ongoing, in fact, between the Dharma Wallas and those in the Advaita world there. One of the, and every, and the traditions have their strengths and practices. One of the very strong messages which comes from Dharma exploration is the profound importance and application of love, of kindness, of compassion, of service. And this voice constantly goes out, and no better indication of it is Tovana itself, with its tremendous ethic of service, its tremendous ethic of making the teachings and practices on dana basis, and the wonderful voices of people in the Sangha who come to offer their services. And the tradition of that is a very strong and precious and beautiful tradition. And in many courses, and in Advaita world and others, sometimes costs are getting higher and higher and higher. And keeping the spirit of that exploration alive as an act of service is part of the Dharma task there. As well, in looking into these explorations there, it's truly keeping our eyes and ears open. And the important thing is not to be, as Stephen was reminding us only today, not to be identified with any system, any idea, any ideology, any unit of thought called Dharma, called Advaita, Yoga, or Zen, or anything. But to have the clarity and the wisdom to draw from, to see what the insights are, what makes a difference to our life, and therefore to have some freedom and flexibility to listen, to engage, to see what different teachers and teachings are offering, not with a view to taking up one and holding on to it, but to see what can emerge out of it that can touch the deep within the being and really shed some insight and light on our life. And of course, I'm a Dharma Waller. I'm a Buddha Dharma Waller down to the toenails and beyond. And so when time to time I'm asked such a question, I can't give a single view of the Buddha Dharma. All that I can say, as I mentioned, there are a diversity of things which touch me and I deeply, deeply appreciate, and I love down to my toenails this radical voice from the Buddha, while at the same time dismissing, forgetting, rejecting and having no interest in a lot of stuff which took place 2,500 years ago, which is not simply relevant to where we are living. And that discernment is part of one's clarity and practice. Is this workable? Is this usable? Is this important for today? And we have to use our intelligence. We have some, not much, but enough, to be able to leave behind in the old what's not our cup of tea, what's not working for us, and really bring then that together what really is effective. And that's an ongoing discourse that's going on in the West at the present time. In a way, the little exploration that we had with regard to the value and the benefits of Advaita, in a way, kind of went over into the next inquiry, in a way, because it was a classic situation, and it's a common one, and I think it's probably the most common duality which I hear, hear from the yogis. Here and daily life. It is the one which we hear the most. And, of course, what we offer or say is we give a little 20-minute, half-an-hour pathetic talk about the transitions from here to daily life. Most of you could recite it backwards there, but it's that question. Of course, there are real challenges in the daily life. Of course, we need to be able to reflect on some of the significant beneficial things that have happened here. Of course we need to find bridges with other people and connect. Because we have to find, and it is the urgency of the time, the beautiful and profound things which are stated here, which are felt here, which are known here, which are discussed and talked about. We have to get that fused in that world that we come from. That's everybody's task. And I fully agree with the person there, just reminding us of the size of that gap, how big a challenge it is, how much boom, boom, boom is coming to us every day. But we're practitioners. As practitioners, we have more responsibility. As explorers of non-dual, mean non-divisiveness, we have a responsibility. As explorers of the power of love and compassion, we have the responsibility. As human beings committed to being awake and staying awake, we have responsibility. So with all the practices, with the ethics, with all the engagement, comes great responsibility. And that dialogue, that discourse between here and there is the fundamental discourse. If it doesn't work out there, it's not worth coming here. You're right. Okay, quiet minute. Enough.